In July 2004, just a month after his high school graduation, Brian Boyle was involved in a horrific accident in Southern Maryland. The car he'd been driving was crushed by a dump truck. Brian's injuries were catastrophic. He suffered severe blood loss. He spent 2 months in a medically induced coma and underwent multiple surgeries over a long hospital stay. Brian Boyle not only survived that trauma, but he thrived, returning to form as an athlete, even competing in Ironman contests. Now, Brian Boyle offers a unique perspective on the healthcare system, how medical professionals can better relate to trauma patients and their families. Brian Boyle on the importance of care, communication, and compassion in the hospital room on Midday After the News. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Our second hour, Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us. In July 2004, just a month after his high school graduation, Brian Boyle ended up in a medically induced coma, unable to move or speak, yet able to hear, see, and feel pain. He'd been the victim of a horrific car crash when a dump truck hit his Chevy Camaro while Brian was driving home from swimming practice in Southern Maryland. Emergency responders used the jaws of life to get him out of the wreck. His injuries were catastrophic. His lungs collapsed. His ribs were shattered. His pelvis was crushed. He lost 60% of his blood. At Prince George's Hospital, as Brian passed in and out of consciousness, questions raced through his mind. However, he was unable to speak to ask them. He felt trapped in his own body. Why couldn't he move? Why couldn't he talk? Was he going to be like this for the rest of his life? Brian Boyle spent 2 months in a medically induced coma and underwent more than a dozen major surgeries. His doctors were unsure if he would ever walk again. But over many months, Brian Boyle worked tirelessly with doctors, nurses, and physical therapists. And 1 year later, he was on the swim team at St. Mary's College of Maryland. And just 3 years after the accident, Brian competed in the Ironman Triathlon in Kona, Hawaii, and on his way there, he stopped in to Midday and was a guest at our show back then. Currently, Brian Boyle is pursuing a master's in communication with a concentration in health communication and a master's of business administration with a concentration in healthcare management from the Johns Hopkins University. His book that I mentioned was Iron Heart. That came out in 2011. That detailed his journeys from the accident through intensive care, the ICU, and then competing in the Ironman. And today, Brian is here to discuss a new book I'm glad to see. It's called The Patient Experience, The Importance of Care, Communication, and Compassion in the Hospital Room. I say I'm glad to see it because it's nice to have an opportunity to revisit with Brian Boyle, because I remember when he was on our show, and we've stayed in touch the last 4 years through social media. Anyway, Brian, nice to see you again.
Good afternoon, Dan. Thanks for having me today.
Yeah. It's been 4 years already since you went to Hawaii.
It's been a couple years, yeah.
Yeah.
It's been a journey.
This is interesting to me. So you decided to pursue master's in communication and in business.
Yes.
Through Hopkins. So what have you been doing? I mean, you've been keeping yourself in shape. I see that. You look trim and fit.
Thank you.
But what have you been doing since 2011? What have you been doing these last 4 years?
Been living life every day, and my journey back to life has been based on helping others, making a positive impact in the community. As a national volunteer spokesman of the American Red Cross, been volunteering a lot, a lot of blood drives.
Oh, with the Red Cross.
With the Red Cross. Right. And as a healthcare advocate, I speak in behalf of the patient experience, trying to improve the quality of care for the patients in the hospital setting. And that is what this new book is based on, is my experiences.
If you don't mind, I just want to go back to that, to the beginning of the story. We'll cover that quickly here because, well, not too quickly, because people don't know the extent of this. I try to describe it there, the extent of your injuries and how impressive it was that you came back from it. I've seen the photograph of the dump truck and the Camaro. I forgot the answer to this question. Do you have any memory of the accident?
The memory of July 6, 2004, the day of the accident, is unknown. no memory that day due to the concussion that I sustained from the accident itself. I remember waking up in a hospital bed. It could have been days later, it could have been weeks later. The concept of time stopped when I was in the accident. And when I was in a medically induced coma, the in and out of consciousness, the sedation, the heavy medications, it made a very blurry kind of real life scenario to wake up to.
Hmm. And in the years since then, none of that memory has come back, being on the road in your Camaro and the accident itself?
No. Luckily, no memories. And the doctors did say one day there's a possibility I could have that subconscious memory, that reflection of the day of the accident. It could come back to the surface. But luckily, nothing has happened since then. Everything before the accident is all intact. Everything's great. But because of the concussion, the day of the accident, it is definitely definitely a blur.
And that's how it was explained to you by doctors?
Yes.
Because I, if you don't mind, I was curious what you would say about that because of the Amtrak accident in North Philadelphia just last week, and the story that we're getting that the engineer of that train had no recollection of what had happened. I guess it didn't surprise you to hear that.
The mind is a very unique thing, because the way that you experience things in life, and I feel like sometimes with a traumatic situation, your mind almost becomes a helpful ally. It shuts down in the time of need. When that traumatic situation happens, it can shield you from those memories, those tragic memories.
You went into a coma. They put you into a coma.
Yes, from all the operations, they thought it would just be best to have me in the coma for the time being.
And I try to describe the way you describe it in your book a little bit. What that was like, not being able to speak,
yes,
but having a question about where you were, what the circumstances were. Can you describe that a little bit for our listeners?
Waking up in the medically induced coma in room 19 of the ICU was waking up into a living nightmare. It was like a locked-in state, almost like a mental prison in a lot of ways. I was tuned into my environment. I was tuned into my surroundings. The people came into my room. I was engaged with them. I couldn't speak or communicate. I was paralyzed, but I was very aware of my surroundings. And it was a very scary environment to wake up to. But because of my parents being there, because of my care providers being there, and the people that were supporting my recovery, it helped make that situation bearable.
And what do you know now about how long you were sort of out of it before you were able to recognize people again, say your parents, for instance?
It could have been days. It could have been weeks. So when I woke up into the hospital bed, it was based on just trying to figure out how did I get here? Why am I here? What's going to happen to me day to day, week to week? And my parents are saying, Brian, you were in a car accident. You had a few broken bones, but you'll be out of here in a few days. They were trying to keep my hopes up. They didn't know if I was understanding what they were saying. Nobody really knew based on the external surface of what I looked like and what I was comprehending and what I was showing communication too. So for us, it was a day-to-day scenario, and I just had to depend on the people around me to understand what was taking place each moment of every day.
What was your vision like? Could you see people in the room?
It depended on how my bed was situated, but usually I could see the foot of my bed. I could see the TV in the right-hand corner of the wall in my room. I could kind of see out into the ICU. But other than that, it was pretty much based on wherever my eyes were fixated at that time.
Do you remember the first time a doctor told you what the extent of your injuries had been? When you had reached a point where, I don't know if you were recovering, but you were in the process of recovering, when you could actually consume all that information, when a doctor felt comfortable telling you about the extent of it?
I remember when I was able to learn how to talk again, when I had the speaking valve and I had the trach and everything, I was able to communicate. This was near the end of the 2-month stay when I was in ICU. I was asking so many questions. I was trying to comprehend everything and digest everything that was taking place. And I would ask those pretty serious questions. And that's how I found out about the extent of the injuries, the operations that I had, what my life expectancy was, the difficult questions that I had that I needed answers to. That's when I received
So you had to ask questions. I'm just imagining a moment when a doctor says, Brian, I want to tell you exactly what happened to you on July 6, 2004. But that came to you in bits and pieces, it sounds like.
It would come from my stay in the hospital. It would come from my parents that were my parents were talking to me, explaining the situation. I had questions for them as well. And there were days when I had conversations with my nurses and my therapists and my doctors, and we would go through the process of what took place, what actually happened. And I think I was so fascinated by that situation that I wanted to figure out every little detail taking place. And I just wanted to communicate. I was so lonely in that coma. I was so just trapped in that locked in state. Any kind of communication that I had just really kind of helped that mental stimulation, that sensation, and helped me almost leave that environment that I was in temporarily and just escape into a good conversation.
Hmm. So you needed that.
I needed that tremendously.
You say in the book that every day I had questions but rarely received answers.
Yes, and that was more so for my parents because they were asking a lot of questions based on what was taking place each day. And it was a very serious environment to be in ICU, and my life expectancy was unknown. The prognosis was grim. And it was just based on just trying to find hope, trying to find answers, just taking the time to understand what was taking place. That's really what kept us going, was having that feedback.
Brian, would you mind just describing, or for the record, just telling us about those operations that you had, what you know about them now? At the time, you weren't conscious of them, right? You were in a coma.
Yes.
But what were you told since then? How many were there? I know that in Iron Heart, you reported dying several times.
Yes.
We remember last time you were here, we talked about that. If you just don't mind relating those facts to us again.
Over the years, I have looked at the medical records. It was a stack about a foot high off the table. And I remember just looking back and just being so, I don't know, motivated and inspired by looking at what the human body can go through. And I remember looking at the operations, and I'm seeing the heart going across the chest. Open heart surgeries. I'm hearing about the livers being lacerated, the kidney being lacerated, everything kind of failing, the major organs being damaged, being repaired, lungs collapsing, being repaired, the pelvis being shattered. It was just an ongoing procedure every single day. If one thing wasn't failing, another thing was. And once something was able to get back into regular function again, then other things would start to fail and fall behind as well. And it was the vital organs. It was the heart, the liver, the kidneys, the lungs. It was a very much needed amount of blood that I needed. I needed 36 transfusions and 13 plasma treatments.
36 transfusions and how many plasma treatments?
13 plasma treatments. Wow. And being a shock trauma patient, it was very serious. Every day was just a waiting game for the recovery, for the body to show signs of life. And luckily, there was no paralysis, no spinal damage, no brain damage, and that was a miracle in itself.
Did all of the treatment take place at one hospital?
I had my 2 months in ICU at Prince George's Hospital Center, yes.
Wow. I looked on a map because I read at a website of a volunteer fire company. I think it was Akakik.
Yes.
Volunteer Fire Company, where the accident took place. So I looked on a map. It was Ripley Road and Poor House Road.
Yes.
In an area that's called Ripley. It's Charles County. And I wonder, have you ever been back there?
I have been back on unfrequent visits, time to reflect, time to just go back and look at the journey back to life. I don't drive there myself. Usually my mom or my dad, they drive me there and everything. So when we go there, it's usually just a time to reflect and everything.
You've gone there actually to stop and reflect on...
Yes. It's only 5 minutes from my house, so it's right down the street.
So most of the time you just drive by it.
But
sometimes you stop and actually reflect on what happened there and
yes.
All that's happened since?
Mm-hmm. Yes. We've done different interviews there over the years with the Red Cross, and I've done different projects based on that whole experience.
Brian Boyle's new book is The Patient Experience, The Importance of Care, Communication, and Compassion in the Hospital Room. And I noticed that you right up front relay all these facts, and there's the photograph of July 6, 2004, the dump truck and your Camaro. And you look at that photograph, and it's hard to believe that a living human being came out of it.
I see that photo, and I just reflect back on what could have been happening that day. And it's emotional, just seeing the photos and the people that were involved in the accident, seeing my life-saving EMTs and paramedics and volunteer firefighters and policemen and the medevac pilot that got me from the accident scene to shock trauma in my golden hour. That was the foundation of the recovery. And
have you met all those people?
I have.
In the years since then?
That was my goal when I was in my rehab center in Baltimore. I was at Kernan, and I remember sitting in my wheelchair one day reflecting back on what I had been through the previous 2 months, and I'm thinking, I could leave here one day and make a full recovery. And I had a great team of people at Kernan, and I'm thinking to myself, when I leave here, I want to be able to go back and thank those amazing people that were part of my recovery from the accident scene to ICU, to be a visitor and not a patient, to go back and just share the gratitude and appreciation.
Listen, I hope we have a good conversation this hour with our listeners, because I want to include them in this conversation with Brian Boyle, because this book is about being in a hospital for a prolonged period of time. And as I know some people in our audience have, or family members have, and this is what you learn from that experience and reflecting back on it.
Yes.
And what's needed. The importance of care, communication, and compassion in the hospital room. So I was thinking of what kind of a question would I ask my listeners if they wanted to join us in the conversation today? Have you ever been frustrated with whether people were paying attention to you in a hospital? What, Brian? Who is this book for?
I would say this book, when I wrote this book with my parents the previous couple of years, as a healthcare advocate, I believe in healthcare. So this book is for other families that are caring for a loved one in the hospital to help them navigate the healthcare system. This book is also for the patients to help them as they pursue their journey back to recovery, back to a way of life. And also for the care providers taking care of the patient and the family in the hospital room to just overall improve the experience for everyone in the hospital room between the patient, care provider, and loved one that are all in the recovery process together. And in a way, it is about showing a gratitude first, and then it's offering the suggestions and recommendations to help improve that experience. And it's the little things that add up in the long run for the patient and the family members.
All right, we'll get into it when we get back, Brian. We have to take a little break here on the Midday Show. When we return, more from Brian Boyle and his advice to caregivers, especially on how to provide the safest and best care for patients and their families during long hospital stays, especially people who've been through trauma.
Yes.
And need a long recovery period. 410-662 8780 is our phone number here if you'd like to join us. We'll be right back. Have you or a loved one been in the hospital for extended periods of time? What were some of the things that your caretakers did to help you, or what recommendations would you make to that hospital for improvement? 410-662-8780. What are you saying, Brian, overall about your long hospital stay and your therapy overall? If you graded it, would you say it was a B+, an A-, a C? What would you say about your own experience if you had to give it a grade?
I would say, from my experiences, the fact that I'm alive today and I'm breathing and I made a full recovery, I give it an A+.
That's an A+.
Yeah.
I guess I mean, you know, once some time went by and you knew you were going to make it.
Yes.
I don't know when that point was. When was that, by the way? When would you say, oh, I think I'm going to survive this?
Probably the day I left ICU.
which was what?
That was about 2 months after 2 months. I was brought into shock trauma.
I mean, generally speaking, would you say people were treated you well? You were treated well. You were treated, you got all the care you needed. You got the compassion you needed. People communicated well. What would you say?
I would say, from my experience being the patient, I was always tuned in to the kind of feedback and the level of communication, engagement, and compassion. And for me, I had a lot of great care providers, a lot of incredible care providers. And the difference was the amount of engagement and care and communication and compassion and empathy and relating to me as the patient. I wasn't just a body on the hospital bed. I was a person. And the care providers that reflected on that, that got to know me, that spoke to me, made eye contact, held my hand, read my get well cards, looked at my photos, talked to my parents, those are my care providers that became a part of my family.
Do you think you got special attention because of who you were? You're a young guy, athletic, people know your story, they've heard about you, your parents are around a lot. I don't know, after time maybe you become the celebrity patient who's going to survive, people are feeling good about you?
I think when I was brought into shock trauma, being as sick as I was and being brought back to life several times and the extent of my injuries, it was a situation where I was a very, very sick patient. And my parents coming there every single day, and it was an hour drive from where we live in Charles County at the time, having that kind of interaction with my parents and them talking to everyone in the hospital room, everyone in the ICU, everyone in the entire hospital, the cafeteria ladies, the security officers, the president and CEO of the hospital, everyone became a part of our team. And they all heard about the story one way or another. Mm-hmm. And it became that ongoing support system that really inspired me in the moment, even when I was still in the medically induced coma. I'm seeing that. I'm inspired by that. I can see the level of engagement that they're taking care of me, but they're also taking care of my parents and my family and my friends. They're believing in me and supporting me every single step of the day.
So here you are with this catastrophic injuries, and you according to Ironheart, your first book, you died 8 times on operating tables.
That was the magic number in the recovery setting.
But there's a point there where it looks like you're going to make it, so people are pulling for you. And, of course, it's a point of pride for doctors and nurses to save your life. So there's this momentum and energy building, right?
It really was.
It's mostly positive, would you say?
It was positive. And the progression was positive because when I would show any kind of improvement, when I was able to blink, to move my fingers for communication, yes or no commands, it inspired a sense of positive energy, even more so than what was already taking place. And I could see the feedback from my care providers and also my parents. And I thrived off that energy. And I just kept going from that.
All right. Here's something from Chapter 7 of your book. Before stepping into the patient's room. So this is advice to caregivers and visitors.
Yes.
Friends who are coming to see you. You say you report supersensory perception.
Yes.
I could sense the negative or positive feelings of the people in the room. When you say supersensory, you really think you were there, huh?
I had to be there to survive because when I was in the hospital, I had to depend on my perception, my sensations, my level of engagement with the people around me to understand what's taking place. My survival depended on that because I'm in this waiting game, this almost like this scenario where I don't know what's going to happen, what's around the corner, what's going to happen tomorrow, next week, and so forth. If there would even be a next week, I didn't know. So I depended on the people around me, my care team, my parents, family, and friends. So I had to become hypersensitive to the situation to regain that sense of what's taking place in the hospital room with my own recovery.
Is it because you couldn't communicate verbally as
yes,
well?
Yes.
Okay.
I think that the
now did anybody come into the room that you noticed was being, you know, negative and pulled you down?
Yes. Yes.
Friends would come in because they, you know, they'd have a reaction to seeing you in your condition. And
friends and also the visitors. I remember not visitors to my family, but you know, people walking in ICU, it's a very intense environment. It really is. And some of the things that you see, it could possibly frighten some people because I did not look good. And I remember a situation where I was the patient and I was still in the medically induced coma. I couldn't speak yet. And I remember a little girl and her mother, and they walked by my room, and a little girl looked at me and she screamed. And she said, "Mommy, there's a monster in that room." And I looked at her and I just felt my heart went out to her because I felt like a monster. And I felt like what she was seeing, I knew I was scaring her, and I didn't want to do that. And I feel like that kind of situation, it's very important to just have a certain kind of, you know, a sense of overall being when you're going into a place like ICU.
It's tough.
It's very tough.
I mean, a little girl screaming, okay, but say middle-aged man, uncle or brother comes in to see you and is not used to seeing you like this and is fearing that you're going to die still.
Yes.
It's completely understandable if they be crestfallen, even if they start crying.
Yes.
And what are you supposed to do about that?
I was used
stay out of the room?
Well, for me, I remember my parents. They always had, I mean, being my parents, they're my guardian angels, my heroes, and I'm seeing them suffer every day. And that's when I realized that it wasn't just me suffering in the hospital bed. They were suffering as well, 1,000 times worse than what I was going through. And I try to just keep getting better for them, to keep giving them hope, to keep giving them signs of life, to keep them, you know, happy, to keep them motivated. And
how'd you do that?
I just tried to just get back into life again. And my weakest moments in life is about halfway through the ICU stay, and I'm thinking, I'm never going to leave here. I'm never going to recover. I'm never going to leave the hospital. I'm going to spend the rest of my life in this vegetative state and go on to a nursing home for long-term care and spend the rest of my days in that kind of atmosphere. And for me, I just realized that it was up to me to make the decision to keep living. And that came from the motivation from my parents. They believed in me. My care team believed in me. And in those moments, they gave me the strength to keep going. And I realized that it wasn't just about me. It was about this entire support system I had to keep going for.
Brian Boyle is our guest, author of Ironheart earlier and now a new book, The Patient Experience, The Importance of Care, Communication, and Compassion in the hospital room. These are areas that Brian's studying as part of his graduate studies at Johns Hopkins University. Let's take some calls. And we welcome our listeners to join this conversation. If you have an experience to share with us, or from that experience, a comment about the care you were given in a hospital during a long stay in particular, or a family member as well. 410-662-8780 is the number for Midday. Our email address, and I read emails on the air, midday@wypr.org. Brian, this is Robert up in Hunt Valley. Robert, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you very much. Brian, I really appreciate the outlook that you had during your recovery, you know, once you actually gained your consciousness and was able to really digest what was going on around you. I'm a leukemia survivor, and although the definitely no comparison to the story that I'm hearing here, it was very intuitive for me to be like a sponge and to absorb as much information from the doctors, from the nurses, from everyone involved. And I didn't really think about it in the moment, but it in the end, it really brought me a lot of solace in understanding what was going on. And the my family and friends, everyone who experienced you know, the leukemia treatment and all the ups and downs and ICU visits and everything along with that, they really drew from my understanding of what was going on. And I think then from that is my appreciation that I have towards my hospital, which was the University of Maryland Greenbaum Cancer Center, and that they were more than happy to indulge, you know, almost every minute of my day with the details of what was going on.
Robert, you asked a lot of questions.
I'm sorry. Yes.
You asked a lot of questions. Yeah.
Yes. I asked a lot of questions. So I mean that I don't know. I think that really improved my experience. But the hospital was so willing to engage in the dialogue of all the details of fungal pneumonia that cropped up, or you know, different ailments that cropped up as a result of the chemotherapy treatment. And you know, afterwards, I'm just so thankful for the hospital being so engaging as they were.
It sounds like people were willing to share information with Robert no matter what question he asked. Some patients maybe don't want to know as much as Robert either.
Yes, and Robert, congratulations.
Everyone's different, right?
Yes, and that's the thing, too, because from my experience and having that kind of ability to engage and ask the questions, it creates a foundation of the path of recovery. You can see where you're going, what's around the next corner, what's around the next part of the recovery process. And that helps both the patient and also the care providers, the primary care providers, the family members taking care of the patient in the long run. And for me, having that kind of ability to ask those questions and have those answers being given, it provides a sense of guidance and hope in a lot of ways.
What did you learn from your own experience in terms of the time, doctor's time, nurse's time? How much time they have actually to give you? Because an assumption a lot of people make is that nurses, of course, are overworked. Doctors have a lot of patients' rounds to make and are busy in and out of hospitals, driving here and driving there, and can only spend a few minutes with you.
I had dozens of care providers, and it depended on the time of day, the time of week. And I remember just having that interaction where that entire support system, everybody played an integral role in a recovery. I had the nurses and the therapists and the doctors and the physical therapists, respiratory therapists, radiologists, pain specialists. Everybody had their set time, their set responsibility in the hospital room for my recovery process. And it was kind of built around that kind of cycle on what's going to be taking place that time of day, that time of morning or evening. And I was just always so focused on just being prepared for that and being ready to, when I was able to speak again, to ask those questions and just to have that conversation with them.
And so you never felt like anyone was so pressed for time they couldn't spare it for you?
Well, I knew, especially being an ICU patient, I was one of the. I mean, everyone in ICU is very, very, I mean, it depends on the situation, but usually pretty critical. And in my situation, I was very critical. And I knew that the time was precious that I had with them. But they would come into my room. I remember a situation where one of my main surgeons came into my room, and he sat down next to me. He watched my vitals for an hour, and we watched Indiana Jones together. And I was still in a medically induced coma, but he sat right next to me. He talked to me. And that kind of engagement.
How do you know he did that?
Because I remember him sitting right next to me.
Excuse me, I'm trying to get a sense of what's going on with you when you're in a medically induced coma. You still have some sense of who's in the room, who's with you?
In a lot of ways, I think it depends on when the medication is being weaned off. When I was able to have my days when I could comprehend what was taking place, even though on the surface, my face and my communication skills and my levels of being able to respond to different commands, some days I could do it better than others. Some days I was just completely paralyzed. Near the end of the 2-month treatment, when I was in ICU, I was able to really respond and being weaned off the medication completely. But in the early stages, I was on full paralysis medication. And even then, in a lot of those days, I was still very sensitive of my surroundings, very aware of my situation. And the people came to my room, I had nothing else to do but just focus in on what they were doing. And as an ICU patient, that's what I spent most of my time doing.
Lewis in Owings Mills wants to join us next to share an experience. Lewis, welcome to Midday.
Hello.
Go right ahead, please.
I just wanted to thank Brian for the insights that he's sharing with all of us, but also to talk about the role of a patient advocate. I found myself in a situation where my wife needed a transplant, and we it was a month-long process to get approved by the healthcare facility to actually put her on the list, to make her qualified for a transplant, so when an organ became available, she would be considered for that organ. And it took a month. We had to meet with a lot of people. There was competition for attention of all the professionals during that evaluation process. And in order for my wife to be successful in that evaluation process, she needed an advocate, somebody who would talk to all these people, interact with them on our behalf, because she was really sick and near death, couldn't do it on her own. And I'd look around me and I'd see other people who are in a similar situation, and they'd be there in shorts and flip-flops trying to be an advocate for a relative. And I would sense that they wouldn't be given the same attention that somebody who is more of a professional person. And I'm not trying to be class-worthy here, but taking things seriously, being very much attuned to what the needs of the healthcare community were, so that, you know, we could help try to satisfy them from the patient's side of the fence.
Thank you, Lewis. It sounds like your parents played that role for you.
Yes. Every single day they were there, either in the waiting room or they were in my hospital room or going from the hospital back home. And in a lot of ways, they were my patient advocates, because they were there asking questions, getting the feedback, trying to figure out what's taking place, not just for myself and for them, but also for my loved ones, my family and my friends, because they would come into my room every single day and they would find out what was taking place. Then they would go out to the waiting room and tell my family, my aunts and uncles, my cousins, my friends, and then they would go back in the hospital room again an hour later, and they would just go back and forth in that cycle. So it was such an important factor to have the patient advocate aspect in ICU, because it was bringing that line of communication to all levels. And I, with my experiences, my parents' experiences, we've talked about it, it's really important to have that advocate in the hospital setting to kind of help with that overall process with the line of communication.
Brian, have you spoken to doctors and nurses about your experience and all the talks you've given in the last few years?
I on a weekly basis.
Okay. So how do they react to you? What kind of responses do you get when you bring up the 3 C's, care, communication, and compassion? Or, you know, you provide them with your takeaway from your experience and what you're learning as a graduate student now in this field of health communications especially. So what do you get? Do you get, well, you're not telling us anything we don't know? Sure, we'd all like to be more compassionate and spend more time with our patients and communicate better, but we don't have as much time as that takes. What kind of response do you get?
The feedback that I've received in the past 7 years I've been speaking as a healthcare advocate on a national platform, it has been positive, because when I speak to doctors and nurses and EMS and all various levels of healthcare, even up to the CEO and president level, it is about that support system. So I always share my gratitude first. I always share my appreciation. Then I share my experience. And then I offer, you know, little suggestions here and there that can improve the experience for the patient and the care provider. I never critique the system. And I'm always speaking about how I'm alive because of how the healthcare system is organized.
Well, we're going to hear some of your suggestions after the next break. This is the Midday Show. Brian Boyle, survivor of a traumatic accident in 2004, lives to tell us about his experience and also give his advice for especially for medical providers.
Yes.
Care providers, about how to treat people with extended stays in hospitals in particular. And speaking of patient advocates, Thomas writes on our Facebook page, "This kid is an inspiration. He spoke to an event in Frederick several years ago. His story is remarkable. If you are fortunate enough to meet his mom and dad, you will understand where he gets it from." 410-662-8780 is the number for Midday. We'll be right back. Hey, Brian, you talk about getting to know other people who've gone through a similar situation. These would be people who survived traumatic accidents, right? Have you met people who have had a similar experience as yours?
Yes.
And you found that helpful?
It's very helpful, because with a background like that, especially in a very traumatic situation, not just car accidents, but anyone who goes through some kind of extreme adversity and trauma, it really helps to have that therapeutic outreach, to be able to talk, to share your experiences, to reach out and make a connection with someone who knows what you're talking about.
And when did you do that during all of this? The accident was in July 2004. You were in ICU for 2 months. After that, you said you had to go through therapy at Kernan Hospital?
Yes.
So at what point did you meet others? Was it at Kernan?
It was even in ICU. When I was transitioned from the bed to a wheelchair, I would have the nurses wheel me around, and I would talk to some of the other family members, and I would get to know them and hear their experiences. And I felt like in that moment, I'm just a young guy who's been through quite an ordeal, but I feel like my experiences could help others. And it really went to a different level when I was at Kernan and I'm in my wheelchair and I'm talking to other people in wheelchairs, other people going through a similar adverse situation. And I realized to have that connection with someone who knows what I'm going through and knows what I'm going through at the moment and what I'm thinking and feeling, it really helped a lot for me as a patient, and also for them as well, to have that therapeutic communication.
I forget this part of the story. After all of this, and you were surviving and you were home, you'd gone through therapy, you were back living with your mom and dad.
Yes.
Joanne and Garth, right? When did you decide you were going to be an athlete again? How did that come to you?
I think having that competitive mindset, being an athlete all my life, it helped in the early stages of the recovery. Because when I was at Kernan and I was brought home, I was trying to focus on, if I'm doing maybe 10 feet of walking on this day, tomorrow I'll do 11 feet. And I was always trying to add that progression to the recovery process. And I kept going further and further each day. And it was just setting small goals, which became larger goals over time. And I had to be patient about that. But in the moment, it felt like it was forever. It was about 6 months after leaving ICU when I was thinking about, okay, maybe I can get back in the pool again. Just a doggy
paddle. Because you were a swimmer.
I was a swimmer. And just to get back in that environment, the indoor pool environment, just to get back in the water, not to swim, but just to get back in the water, then I accomplished that. And then a couple of months later, I'm thinking, okay, let's go to college. Let's live my dreams that I had when I graduated from high school. Let's swim on the team when I'm in college. And then 2 years later, let's look at the Ironman, because the Ironman was a race that I had always set out for myself when I was little.
Well, you leapt ahead here in the interest of time.
Big jump there.
Right, but it was little steps.
It was baby steps. It really was.
It really comes down to baby steps.
Yes.
And psychologically,
yes.
How did you, I mean, obviously to me it looks like you held up pretty well, but I'm sure there must have been periods of depression. I'm assuming that. Actually, I think I read that in your first book.
every day there was constant setbacks and struggles, not just for myself, but also for my parents and loved ones. My parents had post-traumatic stress, and they couldn't talk about a lot of the experiences in the hospital because it would bring up too much fresh memories. And for me, I had so many questions at the time, so I had to find that outlet of therapy, which came from either speaking about it to other people who had gone through something similar, writing about it in a journal, or even working on my artwork that I had at the time.
I wanted to ask you about art therapy. I remember a member of my family going through a long recovery from an illness and taking up ceramic mosaics, you know, and that kind of thing. I mean, did you do something like that?
I did. And I was
What did you do?
I was always really big into art when I was in high school and even growing up in middle school and my younger years. I just always liked that creative expression. So when I was going through the recovery process in undergrad, I was focused on the art therapy approach because I was still healing when I was in college. I was still going through recovery and therapy and so forth. So to go to college and focus on art therapy and be able to have an outlet for what I couldn't communicate in words or through speaking about it or writing about it, I could express in my artwork.
And what was your medium?
It was a variety of charcoal. It was a variety of drawing. It was photography, digital photography, short film. In a lot of ways, it was very depressing artwork. But for me, it was my outlet to express what I couldn't communicate.
When you drew something or sketched something, what did you sketch?
Usually, it would be based on the experiences I had in the hospital, the accident scene itself. I would have flashbacks of different things from knowing the accident scene, not actually from the day of the accident, but having memories of trying to piece together this fragmented memory that I had of those 2 months when I was in ICU. And it was almost trying to reflect on that to kind of regain that sense of what took place of that time frame that I had no memory, no recollection
of. Would you draw yourself?
I would do self-portraits.
You draw pictures of your body in a bed or something like that?
I did. It was a lot of pictures. A lot of black, white, and red colors were used in my drawings, and also my digital photography. I did a lot of things very abstract, and I would put things down on paper. Then I would react to it. Then I'd respond to it, and I felt like that was my way of just trying to dig deeper into that subconscious layer that I just could not recollect.
So, what are your suggestions for, say, caregivers, doctors, nurses, when you go to speak to them? What is your takeaway from your experience in terms of relaying to them some wise advice for how they can better treat patients?
From my perspective, being an ICU patient, especially being medically induced in a coma, I always thrived off that level of engagement in the hospital room. So I always try to stress to the care providers of all backgrounds, anyone who comes into the room and interacts with the patient, it's about engaging with the patient. First, you treat the body, then you heal the person. And that's what my main message was, especially being as a healthcare advocate, was going into the room, talking to the patient, whether they can respond back to you or whether they're showing any signs of being coherent and comprehending what you're saying, it doesn't matter. Speaking to the patient is so critical. Engaging with them, reading the get well cards, looking at the photos, getting to know them and the family, getting to know everyone in that hospital room and just trying to help in that recovery process. There's a lot of questions that are being addressed. You can't answer all the questions, but just listening to what they have to say really helps go a long way in the recovery process as well. And just being there every step of the way to add that motivation, to give that hope. Sometimes hope really isn't there, but just making that attempt goes a long way.
Brian Boyle is our guest. His book is The Patient Experience, The Importance of Care, Communication, and Compassion in the Hospital Room. This is the publisher of this book, Brian. Is that Skyhorse
Publishing
Skyhorse.
In New York City.
Very good. Christine in Baltimore is giving us a call. Christine, you're our next caller. Go right ahead. Hi.
Hi. I have a story to share, not necessarily a question, but I have a traumatic brain injury, and it happened 5 years ago in February of 2010. I went up to visit a friend in upstate New York and fell down a flight of steps, hit my head on the window at the bottom of the steps, and next thing I know, I'm waking up in inpatient rehab. I do not remember the ICU experience whatsoever, and my mother had come up from Maryland to be with me during the whole ICU experience. So she has lots of stories to tell about that. I was in a medically induced coma for about 3 weeks, and so I don't remember that experience.
Christine, excuse me. I want to ask you a question.
Yeah.
Is there something from your rehab, from your experience in rehab, that you could share with us that if you were in Brian's shoes, if you were writing a book and giving advice to those who had to care for you, that you would pass along?
Yeah, well, rehab was, it was great. I mean, for having to be there, they were incredibly supportive. And they were just very positive. One thing that I remember specifically is one of my physical therapists saying that, this is serious. This is very serious, but, we can still laugh. And it was like, they tried to be very, try to keep us in a good frame of mind and, remember that we're still human and that we're still people and we can still be light and, human. And just, I don't know, they were just very...
Good.
Real.
Yeah,
real.
And real. And how are you doing now, Christine? You doing okay now? Right.
I'm still doing rehab, actually. I mean, it's 5 years later. I'm not working. I'm on disability, and I'm still going through outpatient rehab, and I'm working with the Sheppard Pratt Neuropsychiatry Program, and I'm working with Loyola Clinical Center doing rehabilitation, and I can't say enough good things about both those programs.
Brian, it sounds like she doesn't have any complaints, really, about her treatment, her care. It sounds like she was in great hands.
Christine, congratulations on the recovery thus far. That's the thing, too. We can relate on so many levels. And as a patient in the hospital, everything kind of goes on standby, and it's so focused on just getting better every step of the way. And it really helps having the care providers that can relate. And they know it's like a serious situation, but they go about it in a way that keeps the positive energy up. And that really helped on for my situation as well.
Brian, we only have a couple of minutes left. I wonder, do you have a thought about why some patients heal and others don't?
I feel, from my experience, I always speak about just when I was in high school, I had a competitive kind of background, and that kind of helped in the recovery process and trying to set goals for myself and trying to accomplish those goals with the support that I received. And just making that process where I turned those larger goals that I had in the recovery process, like getting back on my feet again or going back in the pool and just trying to get back into the regular way of life that I used to have, it was setting those small goals, the short-term goals. I made them even quicker.
So what happens to those who don't do as well? They don't set goals at all, or the goals are too extravagant?
I think it's about the larger goals being condensed down into the shorter goals, the more achievable goals, and then as time, being patient, just having those goals add up. And the plans that we have in life, they're not always going to be the way that we hope that they turn out to be and everything. So for me, from my experience, it just comes down to just staying positive, optimistic, and just hoping that tomorrow would be a better day. And for me, from my background, luckily it was.
And is your life turning out today the way you envisioned it when you were 18 before that accident?
July 6, 2004, it definitely changed my life in a lot of ways, but sure, it's given me a platform to help others and make a difference and to be able to live each day to the fullest without being on a ventilator and so forth.
But
so,
you're 28 now. Did you imagine that you'd be doing something like this when you were 18? At 28, you'd be studying toward a master's at Hopkins and health communication, health management?
It's definitely a different path than I originally set, but I was hoping to be able to be in a position one day to help others. That was kind of like my goal when I was, I mean, back then in high school, I wanted to be like maybe a sports psychologist or something like that. So in a lot of ways, it's kind of in that same path, just in a different spectrum of things. And especially with this book out that's right now, it's about reflecting on that kind of psychology of the patient, to reflect on how a patient goes through the recovery process with their loved ones, their friends and family.
And what they need.
And it helps kind of give the guidance there. And this whole book is about sharing the guidance and the appreciation in a lot of ways.
Well, it's great to have you back with us today, Brian. Nice to see you again. You look great.
Been working hard.
Yeah, and you sound good. Yeah, Brian Boyle, author of his first book, Ironheart. That's what we call him, Ironheart. But the new book is The Patient Experience, The Importance of Care, Communication, and Compassion in the Hospital Room. I see Dr. Peter Pronovost of Hopkins likes your book. He gave you a blurb for it. Another great guy. Anyway, Brian, congratulations on the new book, and continued good luck with you and inspiring people. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate it.
And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. That's our midday for today. We'll see you again soon.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Our interns are Aaron Morenzi, Alexis Kuhn, and Aliyah Satterfield. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.